We're going to be taking a look at some strange missing persons cases, sometimes resulting in deaths, and some very cryptic clues left behind. In the 1960s, talented musician and songwriter Jim Sullivan's debut album was lauded by many as an incredible, evocative and haunting body of music. Entitled UFO, it was recorded in 1969 in Los Angeles. Despite the success of it among aficionados of that type of music, however, he didn't hit the big time. His album had been recorded with session musicians who'd backed stars such as the Beach Boys. But sadly for Jim, his profile failed to reach the heights of this band. And it seems that feeling frustrated by this lack of success, despite his many fans, he decided to try his luck in Nashville, to see if he could get his big break there. So in 1975, he left his wife and young child, promising them that if he could get work there as a musician in Nashville, then he would stay there and send for them to come. But he never made it to Music City in Nashville. He never arrived there. While driving through the desert of the Southwest, he simply vanished without trace. His disappearance is as mysterious as the lyrics in his songs, and his disappearance has never been solved or explained. Cryptically, the lyrics to his songs include such lines as, "I found a magic man, I bought a pound of magic and a kind of dream and plan. Lot of tricks were pulled in a book I read, only man I know that got pulled up from the dead. And looking at the sun dancing through the sky, did he come by UFO?" Eerily, his lyrics seem to have been a possible foreshadowing of what was to happen to him. Everyone knows of the Roswell incident, but perhaps something just as mysterious and inexplicable happened in the same New Mexico desert 20 years later. Or perhaps there is a far more mundane explanation. When Jim Sullivan left home and set out in his car along the New Mexico desert highways, no one could have expected it would be the last time he was seen. At some time in the early hours of March the 5th, 1975, he checked into a motel in the small town of Santa Rosa, 2 hours outside of Albuquerque, on Route 66, after leaving his family the day before. Perhaps he was very tired as he drove, because a highway patrol officer saw his car weaving along unsteadily and instructed him to stop and do a sobriety test. Jim passed the test, however, and as he was found not to be intoxicated, the policeman allowed him to go on his way, although perhaps did advise him to stop for the night, because soon afterwards he checked into the motel. The next day, his motel room was found locked from the inside, the key left there, and his bed looking like it had not been slept in. He was nowhere around, and his car was gone. Later, the car was found about 25 miles away from the motel, parked up very close to a ranch property. The car was locked. It was parked in the middle of the road. For some, the man's disappearance captured the fascination, despite it happening many years ago. And one man, called Matt Sullivan, who shares the same surname but is no relation to Jim, became so intrigued by the tale and the mystery, he set out to investigate what could have happened to him. Matt Sullivan, who runs an independent record label called LightInTheAttic.net, was a big fan of the vanished man's music. The strings, his voice, It's all so dark and eerie, he says. With or without his disappearance, there's something in those lyrics as incredibly eerie and mysterious. Well, armed with filmmakers, he set out to record his investigation. The family who lived on the ranch outside of which the missing man's car was found had long since moved away. But Sullivan managed to track down the original news reporter who had covered the discovery of the car and the absence of Sullivan. And he also spoke to many of the missing man's friends. One music friend told Matt that he and the missing man had once sat together long into the night, talking about how they would disappear if they ever got to that point in their lives. The missing man said his way of doing it would be to walk off into the desert. Perhaps that's what's happened then. But for the vast majority of those who knew him, they all said he would never have just walked off, and he would never have left his beloved guitar. The one thing that everyone who knew the missing man emphasized was that his guitar was found in his car, and they believed he would never have voluntarily walked off without it, even if he had somehow reached a point of despair. They just couldn't see it happening. If he had planned his disappearance too, they said he would in no way have vanished purposely without taking his guitar. He needed it to make any kind of living, even if it was just busking in the street for a few dollars a day. The wife he left behind, too, is not convinced that he planned to disappear. She said he felt he could make a better progress with his career in Nashville. Our plan was he'd go there, and if he made it, even a little money, then we'd go there and join him. He was going to call en route from the next stop, but then I never heard from him again. We found out he'd never left Santa Rosa. Well, Matt Sullivan told the New Mexico radio show All Things Considered. So he leaves L.A. with $120. He starts driving, and 15 hours later checks into a motel in Santa Rosa. His car is found 25 miles away from the motel, and he's never seen or heard from again. The ranch outside which his vehicle was found, parked in the middle of the road, was owned by an Italian family. And after a full-scale search was initiated by the local police, rumours started that the Italians living there were connected to crime families in the mafia. The police believe that the missing man either knocked on the ranch's front door or that the rancher's wife went out to the car accompanied by two farmhands to find out why he had stopped his car so close to their property. Of course, the possibility then is that some kind of altercation took place in which some kind of foul play was at hand. But this is all just speculation because no evidence was found by the police to support this. And search parties found no trace of evidence indicating foul play had taken place. But that, of course, leaves three other possibilities. One being that he had planned his disappearance before even leaving his family home and had put his vanishing plans into place, among which would have had to have included arranging for someone to come and pick him up. He could have been picked up that night out in the desert and disappeared to start a new life. And yet there wasn't a single person who knew him who could have ever imagined him abandoning music and never playing again. It was everything to him, and it was all he did. Even if he hadn't hit the big time, like many others, they couldn't see him forever abandoning his one passion in life. Nor could they imagine him never getting back in touch with the wife and son, Chris, that he left behind. He has never contacted them, nor any of his hundreds of friends. No one has ever been able to work out why he drove along that road and parked outside the ranch, at a strange angle across the road, either. In Matt Sullivan's search for answers, he made phone calls, corresponded by email with people, went to the extent of hiring private detectives, He even consulted with palm readers and psychics, trying to find any clue that would lead them to finding out what had happened in the desert that night. Had he walked into the desert and died? Wandered off into the barren, uninhabited land to kill himself? And yet how far could he have walked away from his car that night? If he had walked away to die out there, searchers would have come across his body in the following days and weeks that they searched for him. Perhaps it's relevant that the ranch family moved quite soon after he disappeared, and the sheriff, who had been in charge, retired. Then again, they're most likely completely unrelated. On the other hand, with the album he had recorded being entitled UFO, and his lyrics speaking of being taken up into the sky, perhaps there is far more to his disappearance than we would wish to imagine. He had written in his songs, "Looking at the sun dancing through the sky, did he come by UFO? I found a magic man, I bought a pound of magic and a kind of dream and a plan." Well, of course, there's no evidence at all that it happened that way. No accounts or trace evidence to go on. But it all seems we'll never know what really happened out there in the desert that night. Al Dobbs was his close friend and the music producer who first discovered his talent. And he too was captivated by his songs. He said his music was totally different. I had not heard anyone put words together like he did. Well, according to Dobbs, at some time after checking into the motel, his good friend had got back on the road and driven 26 miles down a dirt path going into an absolute wilderness. Dobbs speculates, did something go wrong, possibly, and you have a cover-up? Alluding, perhaps, to an encounter with the ranching family, or others, out on that remote road. But he adds, too, both he and his wife had a very long interest in the history of UFOs. They were, as many of us were, fascinated by something from another world. We wanted to believe. I want to believe. I'd love to see them. For at least 18 months, Sullivan's family, state police, and volunteers all combed the area in which his car was found. But they found nothing that could explain what had happened to him. And now, so many years later, it's unlikely that we'll ever know what happened. According to the Prescott Courier of Arizona in 1988, on the night of Halloween, a man called Larry Rivers was driving along a dirt road in the desert when he came across a man walking. Slowing down the car and opening his window, he asked the man, "What are you doing out here?" "I'm looking for the beast," the man on foot replied. The man's name was David Stone, and he was wearing just a t-shirt and shorts, despite it being winter. This was believed to be the last time he was seen alive. Nearly a week later, he was officially reported missing. His remains were not found until 4 years later, when three hunters stumbled across them. The former deputy sheriff, William Cavalier, said, "It's just about the strangest thing that ever happened round here." When the man was reported missing, the search for him was massive. Planes flew overhead, teams of searchers covered and recovered the ground with bloodhounds. There was no sign of him. His tracks were found, but it seemed they just stopped. The missing man, David Stone, had been travelling en route from San Diego to El Paso in Texas, where he was due to be best man at a friend's wedding. When he didn't arrive for the wedding, his father contacted all of the sheriff's offices between San Diego and El Paso. None of them had received any reports about the missing man, but the local sheriffs did subsequently discover his car on Route 80 in New Mexico, parked at an odd angle, nearly 15 miles south of Forks Road. The search for him lasted almost 2 weeks until it was called off. His remains were found when hunters, 4 years later, saw bones in a granite outcrop about a mile from the highway. One of the hunters, Ken Milberg, said he thought at first they were animal bones, but as he got up close to them, the first thing he picked up looked to him very much like a human jawbone. He knew then that the bones were not animal at all. They looked distinctly human. Although the hunter said the skull appeared shattered from the back, the exact cause of the missing man's death was unable to be determined by the medical examiner, Mr. Mani Yetshami. He said, "There is no reason to believe there was any trauma. He did not sustain any injury before or at the time of his death. And although his skull was in pieces, the doctor believed that this was due to animal predation. Any personal items, such as the man's car keys, his wallet and a necklace that he wore, and all of his clothing, were all missing from the spot in which his remains had been found. The only thing that was found were the remains of his shoes." The leader of the county search team at the time, Ralph Dardy, said that their search for the missing man was one of the strangest in his long years of experience. When Stone walked into the desert, he left behind him some very mysterious and hard-to-fathom clues. He left his car near pyramid-shaped mountains, and as searchers followed his initial trail, leading northwest from his car, they came across a pile of small rocks that had been formed into a pyramid and enclosed in a triangle of rocks. The following day, the searchers found another pyramid of rocks further on, and beside this was the missing man's Rolex watch. Stone had been a very successful stockbroker and obviously wealthy enough to have afforded a Rolex. A couple of miles further, the searchers discovered, written in the sand of the desert, the Fibonacci sequence. But instead of the traditional ending of the number 21, it ended at 18. Some say this was Stone's way of signalling that he needed help. But if so, why did he need help? What was happening to him? The bloodhounds led the searchers on a 13-mile trek following the man's scent to close to Highway 80, where it stopped. In his abandoned car, they discovered a note which said, "They think the word is in the safe. 6 knives in Rob's room. You buys your tea and you takes your chances. Halloween." No one's been able to work out what that message meant, nor what happened to him that night. A couple of other witnesses came forward after his death to say that they had also seen him the night of Halloween. And when they'd spoken to him, he'd said the same thing, that he was looking for the beast. An Australian politician and justice of the peace went to his grave without ever getting an answer to the mysterious death of his son. His son had been found on their farm property in Telbang, Queensland, New South Wales, Australia. He was dead in a field. It was 1971, and the politician, Lindsay Hartwig, was a member of the Queensland Legislative Assembly and a judge. He was a well-educated and very rational man. Not accustomed, certainly, to any outlandish speculation or claims. However, something would happen to him as well as his son that would make him reconsider everything he thought he knew. On June the 11th, 1971, his 19-year-old son Graham had gone out into the fields to fix fences with one of the farm workers. He was later found dead, but his cause of death was never determined. His files, too, have been sealed. Earlier in that day, the politician had been out on his property and had stumbled across a ring of dead grass, approximately 6 meters in diameter. Where it was found bordered an area of heavily forested shrub. It appeared to look like the grass had been somehow burned, although the grass inside the perfect cylinder-shaped burn was healthy. His son had then apparently vanished later that day, while he was out on the extensive property helping the farm worker, at a distance of about 2 kilometres from the farmhouse. When he was found dead, he had a strange mark on his face, but it was said that the doctor in attendance would not let his father see it up close. His son's body was lying just 150 metres from the circle of burnt ground that his father had stumbled across earlier, before his son had disappeared. 2 years later, the father was out alone in his truck. When he described what happened next, he said, "Now I'm sane, and I'm a bushman. I was the greatest disbeliever in flying objects. And yet there in the sky hung 2 pale green objects, like gemstones. They were oval. This is something I've never been able to answer, but it takes me back to my son's death." He asked rhetorically, and alluding to the idea that these spheres were from a dimensional place other than our world. These beings lived. "Did he meet up with these people?" he asks. Bill Chalker, a veteran examiner of trace evidences, who worked for the Australian Physical Trace Cases Organisation, recorded that a few months after the son's death, there was still a 6-metre-wide ring next to the heavily forested shrub on the politician's property. He said it was burnt grass, which may or may not have been of fungal properties, and that it was a perfect circle. He also verified that the sun had been found about 150 metres away from the circle. He added that it was reported there was a strange mark on his face, but an autopsy was unable to reveal a cause of death. The UFO Investigation Centre for Australia also noted that same year a small child in New South Wales had reported a boat with lights over the roof of their home at about 3 a.m., which had hovered and then disappeared really fast. The next morning, the child's father discovered a dark patch in the front lawn. A Dr. Jeff Stevens later examined the ground and found grey powder. The powder has never been identified as any known natural phenomenon. Any attempt to investigate further the death of the politician's son on the farmland proves fruitless, the reason being that his files have been sealed and no one is allowed to access them. The next story happened in 1943, on April the 18th, in the midst of World War II in England, when 4 young boys out hunting for birds' nests in the Hagley Woods in the county of Worcestershire, England, came across something which they could never have anticipated. On passing a witch hazel tree, they noticed its large hollow trunk and they couldn't resist investigating it. The smallest of the 4 boys ventured inside the tree trunk, and to his absolute horror, he found a human skull. Jumping out of the tree in terror, he screamed and told the other boys what was inside, and the group of boys fled in fear and shock, running back home as fast as they could. And although they had sworn not to tell a soul about what they had seen, one of them couldn't resist talking about the grisly discovery. He was so traumatized by finding the skull, which still had patches of hair attached to it, and he broke down and told his father what he had seen in the tree in the woods. His father summoned the local constabulary straight away, who descended on the woods to retrieve the skull and search the scene. Along with the skull was the gruesome remnant of hair still attached to it, and tiny bones scattered, along with tatters of clothing that the victim had presumably been wearing. The local pathologist at the time, Dr. James Webster, determined that on investigation of the bones and the skull, the victim had been a female aged 30 to 40 years of age. Chillingly, it appeared that he had also determined she had been placed inside the hollow tree trunk while still warm, at least 1.5 years earlier. This ruling meant that she had either just been killed when she had been placed inside the tree, with her limbs still flexible enough to position her inside of it, or she had been forced into the tree alive. Also found with the skull had been remnants of a piece of taffeta, which had been pushed into her mouth while she was still alive. All of the dentists in the area were contacted to see if they could match the pattern of the teeth still attached to the skull, but none could. The cause of the woman's death was ruled as asphyxiation caused by the taffeta being pushed into her mouth. But the police, however, could find no correlation with any women on their missing persons lists. Weeks passed by, turning into months, and then suddenly graffiti appeared which said, "Who put Bella down the witch elm?" The message, cryptic in its question, implied, of course, that someone clearly knew more about this than the police did, but they weren't sharing it, other than to leave this enigmatic and rather taunting message. The person who left this graffiti has never been identified, nor either has the answer to the graffiti's question. During a radio BBC retrospective investigation looking back at the case, reporter Steve Punt was contacted by a woman who said she had known a lady called Una Mossop. Una Mossop was a lady who had been married to a man called Jack. Jack was employed at the time of the incident at the local munitions factory, purportedly doing manual work, and yet he was usually seen in rather dapper clothing, despite the war shortages. He was also alleged to have purchased a Royal Air Force uniform, and villagers said he would often be seen wearing it, despite not actually being in the Royal Air Force at all. He often came into the village to stop off at his grandmother's and to have a drink in the pub, usually accompanied by another man who was believed to have been from Holland. 12 years after Bella had been found dead in the tree, this man's wife had gone to the police and given them a written statement which said that her husband had confessed to both her and his grandmother that he had put Bella in the tree. He said the three of them, he, the Dutchman and Bella, had been having a drink and that Bella had become awkward, perhaps meaning that he was saying she'd got drunk. Well, in an effort to, apparently, cool her down, he said he and the Dutchman had apparently shoved her inside the tree and left her there to calm down and sober up. He didn't say he had outright killed her, but rather more that her death had occurred as a result of them leaving her there in the tree trunk. He would go on to tell his wife that he was being haunted nightly by the grisly vision of her staring at him, stuck in the tree and dead. Her eyes were fixed wide open and staring at him. He died at the age of 29 in an asylum for the insane, even before her body had been found in the tree. Rather interestingly, Professor Norma Fenton, who applies mathematical and statistical probability to criminal evidence, stated in the programme that the likelihood, based on evidence, that Jack had killed Bella was actually only 31%. That's not to say he didn't kill her or commit manslaughter, but rather that the available evidence could only statistically say it was 31% likely. The investigation into Bella's death was to take many twists and turns over the years, with some saying she had been a prostitute from a city outside of the area, but with others pointing to the gypsy community as having had an internal fight and her death being the result of it. Then there was also the other rather intriguing possibility that she'd been a spy. A woman called Anna contacted the police to tell them of a spy ring in operation that involved Bella. The woman claimed that Bella was in fact a dance hall singer who was also an undercover spy for the Nazis. In the 1960s, researcher Donald McCormick said that Bella was both a spy and an occultist, whose name was actually Clara Bella, and who had been recruited by the Nazis to infiltrate the munitions factories there. Of course, none of this can be corroborated absolutely, but it did capture the public imagination for years when the story was trickled out by the newspapers, in an era when James Bond novels had just begun being published. Mysteriously, her remains also disappeared, and no one seems to know where they are, nor her final resting place. Curiously, a few months after the skull and remains have been found, a leading anthropologist by the name of Professor Margaret Murray added more mystery to the case by citing the possibility that it could have been a disturbing occult ritual ceremony called the Hand of Glory, and theorising that the scattered finger bones that were found with the skull indicated that a ritualistic murder had taken place. The professor's position was that Bella had been summarily executed in this ceremony, and her hand removed and taken to be used as a hand of glory. The professor had already written books on the subject of the occult and witchcraft across Europe, and it was her belief that there was a secret cabal of witches who had infiltrated the highest levels of English aristocracy and political power. Less than an hour's drive away, 2 years after Bella or Clarabella's death, there had incidentally been the witchcraft killing of Farmer Charles Walton, who had been found lying in a field, a pitchfork embedded into him, pinning him to the ground, and a cross carved into his chest. As for the Hand of Glory, it is said to be the left hand that is taken, the hand of the left path. In the case of executed prisoners, where the taking of a Hand of Glory was said to be more common, this would be the hand deemed to have committed the crime. Literally, the hand that had done the evil deed. The hand would be removed from the executed prisoner, taken away, and pickled or dried out. Often, more was taken from the dead prisoner too. The fat of the corpse would be used to create the candle wax, and the candle, when created, would be placed into the stiff, dead hand. The belief was that this Hand of Glory now held great power, evil power, and that the hand holding the lit candle could stop anyone in their paces. It was believed it would freeze a person. It would prevent a person from moving, from leaving, when confronted by it. The hand of a hanged prisoner was most sought after, as it was believed that the more evil the person's crime, the greater the power of their hand would be for magical purposes. In olden times, possession of a hand of glory was much sought after by thieves, in the belief that it aided them when housebreaking and robbing, by freezing and entrancing the occupants of the houses they robbed from. A real hand of glory is actually on display at the Whitby Museum in Yorkshire, England. Whether or not Bella's hand was taken for this purpose or not, and whether she was a dance or singer but really a Nazi spy, has never completely been established, which perhaps makes it all the more intriguing. Or perhaps it was, in fact, the result of the man who impersonated a Royal Air Force serviceman who hadn't meant to kill her, to shut her up, but who, as a result of his actions, had been driven insane by her spirit returning to haunt him, sending him to the lunatic asylum, where he died at a remarkably young age. A New York advertising man's disappearance from a desolate Wyoming highway has all the ingredients of an intriguing mystery novel, except for the final chapter. The reason the Observer newspaper said this on April the 12th, 1984, is because the final chapter is unable to be written. The mystery itself has not been solved, and it's a complex web of cryptic clues that, despite the passing of more than 30 years, remain ever elusive. His mother once said, "This is a horror, and no one should have to be put through this." His sister said, "It was all my fault that we ever went to that house in Maryland. I'm sorry I even suggested it. I don't know what everything means. It's all so weird. The story is so much more bizarre than I told at the time." It is a story that encompasses everything from UFOs, seances, assassinations, robberies, ghosts, and cover-ups. And of course, the death and disappearance of a young man. This all started because of a seance at that house, and everything went crazy from there. "I still don't like to think about that night," his sister said. Her brother, Donald Kemp, had been working in New York as an advertising executive at an agency. But outside of work, he was a passionate researcher into Abraham Lincoln. In particular, he was most interested in the circumstances surrounding his assassination. So much so that he belonged to a group that shared their obsession for Lincoln, and indeed he spent much of his private time researching too, with the intention of writing a book about it. He'd only recently partially recovered from a traffic accident, and it was believed that he'd been left with permanent injury as a result of it. Whether it was this, as the result of his slow recovery from the accident, as some have theorised, that led him to abandon the rat race of New York City and take off for the wilds of Wyoming in search of tranquility and perhaps to write his book, we're not sure. He'd been researching for the book for many, many months and had amassed an enormous amount of paperwork and notes with which he was going to construct the book. He left New York City with his car full of his belongings and notes and headed west. On his journey, he stopped off at a museum in Cheyenne on November the 15th. Reportedly, he spent a couple of hours there, leaving without realising he'd left behind his briefcase. The next night, his vehicle was found abandoned, with the engine still running, on a remote road in a Wyoming prairie, about 40 miles from the nearest town. He was nowhere to be seen. The doors were open, and a trail of clothing was strewn across the road. A set of footprints in the snow appeared to indicate that he had walked away across the field. But the footprints just stopped. After his vehicle was reported to local law enforcement, a search was initiated immediately. A duffel bag was discovered some distance from the car, containing items that were later identified as belonging to him. And rather strangely, his socks were found 6 miles away in a barn, lying next to a pile of wood, which appeared to have been gathered in order to build a fire. Due to a snow blizzard, the search had to be abandoned after 3 days, but it hadn't been snowing when he disappeared. During the search, local law enforcement said they found no other tracks in the snow apart from a single trail of footprints. They covered the area by helicopter too, but again found nothing that would indicate anyone else had been there. But neither could they find any trace of Don. Though they had found the footprints, they did not find a clear trail to lead them anywhere. The trail of footprints appeared to just stop. The missing man's family asked the sheriff if a search could be carried out using tracker dogs, but it's believed that he said that would not be possible, because blizzard conditions had set in. The police believed he had to have died out in the harsh conditions. He was not in the barn when they arrived there, and he was not out anywhere on the prairie. Crucially, although a blizzard did come, it had not been snowing at the time his car was found abandoned. The snow arrived 3 days later. 5 months later, two separate individuals came forward to say they'd seen him in Casper, Wyoming, in Cheyenne. Then, a close friend back in New York City received several missed calls. She was out of the city when the calls were made to her apartment, but her answer phone picked up the voice messages that were left for her. When she returned, she listened to them. She heard Don's voice, or at least, she was absolutely sure it was his voice. The police did manage to trace the phone number that these calls had come from. They traced them to a trailer in Wyoming. The young male resident of the trailer was a man by the name of Mark Dennis. Unfortunately, he claimed to have no knowledge of the calls ever having been made, despite them appearing on his phone bill. The local sheriff questioned him several times about these calls. He denied having made them. The sheriff said he felt satisfied with this. The missing man's mother, however, was not satisfied. She questioned the young man too, most insistently, determined to get to the truth. But again, he was not able to tell her anything, or rather, perhaps the man was not prepared to. Well, he got a lawyer some months later and eventually moved away from the area. The police convinced he had nothing to do with it, though. It was to be 4 long years later that his mother was able to have some kind of closure. Her son's body was found 4 years later, very close to the spot in which his car had been found abandoned. His body was in pristine condition. It was suggested that he had died of exposure not long after his unexplained disappearance. So perhaps it was a simple but tragic case of a man's unplanned disappearance due to, as some have theorized, a nervous breakdown, which caused him to evacuate his car in the middle of nowhere and walk off into the distance to his inevitable death in the cold climate of Wyoming. The thing is, the story isn't so cut and dried. It really isn't a story that can be given an easy ending, because it left an array of unanswered questions. In what had to be a completely unprecedented circumstance, his body had not attracted any natural predators. No animals or vultures had been drawn to his dead body. There was no way that his body had been covered by snow for 3 years. The snow would have melted. And it hadn't been snowing the night he disappeared. Also, his footprints didn't lead anywhere. Where they stopped, there was no body. and where he'd disappeared. He also wasn't seen anywhere during the search. There'd been no sign of him. His friend in New York, Judy, who'd received the phone calls that she thought was him, said that she recognised his voice. She said he spoke in a strained, urgent voice and gave a number where he could be reached. Her number was unlisted. She couldn't have been called without somebody already knowing her number. The question is, how could Don have made that call when the cops believed he'd died soon after he'd disappeared? His backpack was found soon after his abandoned car was found. Did someone else call her? Someone pretending to be him? Why would they do that? Was it a prank? Was it the guy from the trailer who said he'd never met Don? Or had someone else stolen his backpack? His sister wonders, did this man come across my brother's body and take his possessions, including his phone book? This man looked very, very similar to my brother. I looked in high school pictures. They could have been twins. Did this person kill my brother and take his personal things? Or could it have been a case of mistaken identity? Because they looked so alike, they were practically doppelgangers. The alternatives to the explanation that he abandoned his own vehicle and walked away to certain self-inflicted death is that he was abducted. The problem with this, of course, lies in the lack of a second trail of footprints. Although some sleuths have suggested that an abductor, holding a gun to the back of Don's head, could have stepped in the same footprints as Don to conceal his own. The abductor would have had to have walked a great deal of confidence and carefulness to have succeeded in doing this, however. And the barn where his socks were found was 6 miles from the abandoned car. And yet the footprints seemed to stop quite near to the car. There's never been an explanation about the phone calls. Had Don been abducted? Held at the man's trailer? But then how did his body come to be found in pristine condition and so close to the scene of his disappearance, and yet 3 years after he disappeared? Locals in Wyoming at the time expressed the strangeness of the circumstances. They didn't think his body would have been left alone by natural predators, and the harsh weather was too much and would have taken a toll on his body before it was found, even if it had been frozen and hidden under snow. And how could a body lie out in the open for so long and not be noticed, even, as the police believed, if he'd been there all that time? Even though it was a remote location, the land had to be owned by somebody. Wouldn't somebody have seen his body if it had been lying there for 3 years? Had he been abducted by somebody who had blocked his path on the road? Someone with another vehicle who had flashed at him to make him stop or placed a hazard in the road which forced him to stop? Did someone pretend to be a distressed person in need of his help? If so, why would that person have placed him back in the same spot 3 years later after being killed, and his body left unmarked and completely untouched? None of this makes any sense at all, and yet it gets much, much stranger. After his death, his sister was contacted by an expert professor from the Smithsonian Institute in Washington called Dr. Angel. He phoned and asked if he could see her brother's remains. The family agreed, and his body was sent there. The doctor said his body was in perfect condition, untouched, and he concluded that there was no way he had been lying in the open for the last 3 years. The doctor was an expert in anatomy and anthropology. But how did this doctor even learn about her brother's death? The doctor told them that her brother was missing the hyoid bone, which is a bone in the neck that supports the tongue. He also said there was a small, perfectly round hole in his head. The doctor was insistent that nothing he knew of was capable of causing that hole. He said he had never seen anything like it. The sister says that before her brother left for Wyoming, he'd given her a book, and it was called The Universe. He turned to a page and said, "The Pleiades. I don't know why, but I feel that you may need this. It may be of some importance to you later." Well, his sister put the book on the shelf without reading it. In the same area that her brother disappeared, before they found his body, there was a UFO group run by a Dr. Springer. He contacted Don's sister too. He said they were there because of cattle mutilations. His sister says that they believed that her brother had been taken. They'd been camped out the night that her brother went missing, and they said they were researching cattle mutilations, and they believed that it was related to the fate of her brother. His sister dismissed this. She said in those days, back then, there were no TV, sci-fi channels, no programs about ghosts and aliens. She didn't think it made any sense. She'd never heard of the Pleiadians before. His sister says, "I know this all sounds crazy, and yet I'm talking about the facts." Then there is also something else which plays its part in this story. Something happened before all of this. "It was my fault that we ever went to that house in Maryland. I'm sorry I ever suggested it. I don't know what everything means. It's all so strange." My brother had already done years of research into Lincoln when we visited Surratt House Museum in Maryland. There was a woman at the reception, and when we went in, she asked us if my brother was the man writing the book. When he said yes, she said she had been given a message by someone to give him their name and phone number. I hesitate to talk about this because it unsettles me still, but my brother contacted the person and it turned out to be a young lady. She said she was a psychic and she wanted him to come to a séance. She told him she'd been contacted in regards to the assassination of the president. Well, he said it would be fun to go and that he couldn't pass it up. So one night we went to her house. He brought his best friend and there was a group of us all together, including her husband, and we sat around this lady's dinner table. In the centre was a Ouija board. My brother had brought with him a tape recorder and he set up a camera to record anything that happened. We began and the psychic began to ask questions out loud and the planchette began to move. She then began speaking in a strange voice, speaking with words that were very antiquated, words that we do not use now. She also said things that she couldn't have known, unusual names that she couldn't have known prior before us, and but they were very relevant to us. Some of her knowledge frightened me because she couldn't have known these things. Then she began choking, and I could see a red line forming across her neck. The room became freezing and the camera began to flicker its lights on and off. In the flashing of the camera, I could see the shadow of what looked like a woman in the hallway. It looked like she had a long dress on with a bustle in the skirt. The room became colder than ever and it felt as though evil had entered the room. The room became loud. I know because my brother had to shout over everyone to be heard. I don't know why, but there was chaos in the room, and he shouted at everyone to get away from the table. He got us all together and he said the Lord's Prayer aloud. I guess he didn't know what else to do, but gradually everything returned to normal again. After that, I never went to a séance again. But I know my brother did. I know he stayed in contact with her. I know this is all easy to dismiss and laugh off, but I know this was just not hysteria. I was there when it happened. I know what I saw and I know what I felt and I would never want to have that experience again. A lot more happened after this, but I removed myself from it. That evil, whatever it was palpable. My brother had done years of research among the archives on the assassination. He told me he had uncovered something very disturbing, but he didn't tell me exactly what it was. He didn't specify. Did he uncover something, and did someone know he had found something? Or did they think he had found something? Perhaps it was all coincidence, but I don't know how else to explain all the robberies and break-ins and deaths that followed. In 1983, Don's mother asked one of his friends if he would go to Wyoming and drive back the car that Don had taken. He took a plane and he went to claim the car, then drove the car back to Maryland. The vehicle was broken into when he parked it overnight in a motel as he slept. Many of my brother's missing research papers were taken. When he parked it again, returned to the family in Maryland, it was broken into once more, and further personal items relating to the research were taken. When the remaining items were put into storage, another theft happened. Now, almost all of his research was gone. Some of the remaining papers were given to a historian, who died very soon after in a traffic accident. A few audio tapes remained, which had not been in storage or in the car. They were donated to a man called Mr. Frank Carrington in Virginia. Soon after taking possession of the audio tapes, his house was burnt down with him inside, and he died. Other papers which the family still had were donated to a Civil War store. The owner of the store died in an accident, and the papers were nowhere to be found. Once all of his research had been destroyed or taken, all of the break-ins and accidents stopped. Was his death really about an assassinated president? Were his family fed some kind of disinformation about UFOs and cattle mutilations and seances to divert the family's suspicions that Don had been silenced because of the information he had said he'd uncovered about a president's assassination? And yet the assassination happened so long ago. Was it really that sensitive if a revelation came out? Again, the story has no clear ending, and we'll never really know what happened. What had he uncovered in his research that appears to have resulted in a number of people's mysterious accidents and deaths? But how did this tie in with the book he had given his sister? Turn to a page about the Pleiades. Was there any connection to the purported cattle mutilations in the area? And what about the hole in his head? Well, none of these puzzling questions have ever been answered, and his disappearance and death appear to remain an enduring mystery. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you join me again soon at the Masquerade. But Patreon for exclusive episodes. That's patreon.com/StephYoungPodcast.